Thank you for downloading the Pawneeville Ranch podcast, brought to you by the staff of the Pawneeville Ranch.
Welcome to the Pawneeville Ranch podcast. I'm Erin Brown, Pawneeville Ranch curator.
And I'm Anna Davis, Pawneeville Ranch historical interpreter.
Well, Anna, you know one of our favorite things at the ranch is presenting history to the public in a new and exciting way. There's only so much that we can do when a visitor comes to the site in terms of teaching Pawneeville history. I mean, we only have our visitors for an hour, maybe an afternoon at the most, so a 40-minute tour and them seeing our museum full of exhibits can only really begin to scratch the surface of the wealth of information that we have here at our facility. People who have visited us multiple times are always amazed that there is still new information to be learned about the ranch.
You could spend your life studying Pawneeville and you'll never learn everything. So right. There's always stuff coming up. People are also surprised to learn that not only do we have typical items like photographs and clothing and saddles and guns, but we also have motion pictures and audio recordings of Pawneeville. We've mentioned the motion pictures before with Mae chewing her chewing gum like a maniac.
Yeah.
But the audio recordings are a little bit special. Because Pawneeville died in 1942, his life really bridged a huge portion of American history. In his lifetime, moving pictures were created, radios came into popularity, and electricity lit up households all over the world. Now, some of our most unique items have to do with the latter part of his life, when journalists from all around the world began to interview Pawneeville about his experiences in the American West.
Right. Our focus for this month's podcast is an audio artifact that never ceases to amaze us. In 1939, Pawneeville, a hale and hearty 79-year-old, gave a radio interview to WKY in Oklahoma City as part of a series they were doing focused on historical events of the past. The series also included interviews from Western historical figures such as Charles Goodnight and Pistol Pete Frank Eaton. The fact that the interview still survives today is pretty incredible. But the historic events that Pawneeville describes are equally as incredible. He covers a wide variety of topics, such as outlaws of the American West, which was an incredibly popular topic of conversation in the late 30s. It just seems like the interviewer just keeps wanting to know more and more about that. So it's kind of funny from today's presenter's viewpoint. But he also talks about his time with the Two Bill Show and his involvement in the Oklahoma Boomer Movement.
Yeah, so for this podcast, we're going to bring our listeners the entire interview, which is about 30 minutes long. But before that, though, we like to give you a little historical background, as always. WKY is the oldest radio station in Oklahoma. It was the 87th licensed station in the United States, and it was founded on March 16, 1922, from an Oklahoma City radio shop. From 1936 to 1951, WKY operated from the Skirvin Hotel in downtown Oklahoma City, and every evening they would feature a live broadcast from the Venetian Ballroom from 11 p.m. to midnight, which featured dinner, music, and dancing for all that came to listen. Since its founding, WKY has been many different things. It played popular music, it's played classical music, it was a country music station, a sports talk and news station, and most recently, it is the home to the Spanish language channel La Indomable. It has been home to some notable voices as well, such as Walter Cronkite, who was the play-by-play commentator for the University of Oklahoma football during the 1936 season, Frank McGee, who would become the co-anchor of NBC Nightly News and The Today Show, and Mike Douglas, host of television's The Mike Douglas Show.
In Pawneeville's interview, there are four different people who you will hear talking. The sound quality is a little poor because it was recorded in 1939, but we have worked to clean it up for our listeners. The first voice you will hear is that of the interviewer, the host of WKY's Uncle Leo's radio show. His name was Uncle Leo Blondin. And the second voice is that of Pawneeville. Of course, by this point, he's very elderly, so his voice isn't as strong as it would have been during his heyday with the Wild West shows. And I've got to be honest, the first time I heard this, it really bothered me because he sounds kind of small and weak and a little bit, I don't know, how do you describe his voice, Anna?
He's an old man. He's a very old man.
He has a small old man voice, and it's a little squirrely
sounding. It's a little disappointing to hear his voice, too, because you think he's this larger-than-life figure, and here's this little old man talking, so.
Yeah. But it's a lot of fun to hearing. The third voice is that of the radio technician, whose name is lost to us. And the final voice you hear is a female. Her name is Nellie Ruffner, and she was acting as Punny Bill's nurse and maid. She was actually employed by the Wild West Show as a performer, and she was hired by Punny Bill's sister after May Lily died to take care of Punny Bill in his declining years. So we hope that you appreciate this special treat as we take a personal look into the life and legacy of Punny Bill. We do want to say that at this point in his life, Punny Bill's memory wasn't the best. He had suffered a head injury. So some of the things he might say might not be the most accurate. He was also in the business of exaggeration. So we take what Punny Bill says in this interview with a grain of salt. So we hope you enjoy it.
Major Gordon W. Lilly, sometimes known as Pawnee Bill, a true pioneer of the Southwest. We're happy to have you with us today in the studio, Major Lilly. We'd like to chat with you a little while, if we may, and ask a few questions regarding the early days from your wealth of experience and wealth of information. It's an informal talk. We want you to feel free to speak as you will. And we know you're down here today from Pawnee, Oklahoma. That's correct, isn't it? And you came down to be on Uncle Leo's program. We're happy to have you here and to have this opportunity of making this transcription. Going to have a little help on the questions. We're going to start off by asking you first something about your first recollections of Oklahoma when you first came to what is now the state.
I came down here first in 1878. Then I went back to Bloomington, Illinois, where I was born and reared up until I was around 20. And put in 1 year back there, 1 year at school. Then I came back here in 1879 and landed at Pawnee, Oklahoma. It was just a government post in those days. And there's nothing there but just the employees of the government. There was no town or no one allowed to light around there to live or anything of that kind because it was Indian land. Land is being held on which to locating friendly Indian tribes, and the Pawnees were the only one that was in that section at that time. And I was employed then as a teacher and came down there in the schools, the Pawnee Indian schools. So later on, of course, I got into show business and got into it enough so that I was making money, and finally the Board of Trade of Wichita, Kansas, sent word to me, I was at Easton, Maryland with my show, asking me to come out and take hold of the Boomer movement, as Captain Payne had died about 2 years before that, and that it had laid dead from that time on until now, and they wanted me to take a hold and try to build it up and do something to open the country. So I finally did come down here. That was in 1878.
Well,
wait a minute now.
1878?
Couldn't have been, because I come here in 79. First, that was after...
It was close to that time, though, Major.
Oh, I'll tell you what. Yes, close to 78. It must have been after 79.
Were there any towns, organized towns, in the country?
Not a town in the state. None
Not
of this
one.
Country had been opened.
The Indians were living here, though, very tribe,
that's
true.
Just as wild and woolly as it ever had been.
Yeah, you all had to carry guns, I suppose.
Oh, sure, everybody.
Everybody carried guns. Did they ever use them very much?
Oh, my, yes. They had to.
What was your official capacity, then, when you returned from the East to Oklahoma?
Well, the Board of Trade of Wichita, that was an organization in those days, I suppose, similar to our Chamber of Commerce of today, who had the interests of the city of Wichita at heart, got me to organize and lead the Boomers into Oklahoma.
Captain Payne had been dead then about 2 years, did you say?
3 years.
About
I
3 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were the leader then of the Boomer movement at that time.
I was.
Is that right?
Yes.
What did that consist of exactly?
Well, you mean the number of people?
Yes,
we had over 3,000 on the roll. I think it was 3,600 when the country was opened by a proclamation of, I think it was President Hayes, but I just can't remember.
Were they known as Boomers?
Oh,
at that time, that was their name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Their purpose was exactly what?
To open the country, open
Oklahoma. To white settlements. That is the small territory around the Oklahoma City,
well,
about four counties?
The country that was known as Oklahoma when Oklahoma was opened. It was a piece of land that the Seminoles, as I remember, kind of had control of, but had never used it.
Was their object also to move the Indians out, put them somewhere else?
Yes, oh yes. They did that before it was opened.
Why did they particularly want Oklahoma? Was it attractive for agricultural purposes?
Oh yes, it's planted land, as you know. Look what a wonderful strides Oklahoma has made since the opening.
No one, of course, thought of oil development at that time.
No, nothing said of oil.
Well, now tell us more about the famous characters that you've encountered. Particularly in the earlier days, some of the famous people that we think of as heroes, some of them not necessarily heroic, but they were great bad men, you might say, a few things like that. Do you recall any of them particularly?
Yes, the James boys came down here after the Blue Cut robbery and the Northfield Bank robbery, both, and spent quite a while down here. They always come down here to kind of let the thing blow over and rest up.
Oklahoma was a hideaway for them?
Yeah, kind of a hideaway. Right? That is it exactly.
Was that the original James gang with the younger boys?
Frank and James. I met him on a highway here one day and talked to Frank. I didn't know who I was talking to and didn't know until I got to Caldwell the next day and met some of my friends up there, and they said, "Did you meet the James boys?" And I said, "No, where?" He said, "Where'd you come from?" Well, I said, "I'm come from Fort Sill. It's a 2 days drive, you know, up there horseback," and I was going up the trail of horseback.
Well, how did Frank look?
A genteel, nice-looking man. That is, you'd never mistrust him being an outlaw at all.
Have you seen the motion picture,
Jesse James?
Yeah. Is the character of Frank more or less real, or?
I think so. I liked it because Frank was not a braggadocious sort of a fellow. He was very quiet.
Was he the brains of the gang or not?
The brains of the gang.
He was. That's true. That's known to be a fact.
Always been known that ever since I knew him.
Were the younger boys with him that day?
No, nobody but Frank and Jesse.
Uh-huh. Well, the story that they sometimes say, rob the rich, save the poor, is that actually true?
Well, that I don't know from experience, only just what I hear. I do know this, that their own actions proved it out, that Missouri and any place where they were well known, that they were awfully well protected. That is, you couldn't get anybody there to
tell on them.
Stay on them, same thing again. And I've been told, I heard this, years and years ago, that whenever they'd go anywhere to get something to eat, if they were plenty flush, when they'd get up, they'd lay a $10 bill down, or a $5 bill down for the breakfast or dinner or whatever it was. Of course, in those days, you wasn't supposed to pay anything, because everybody that lived in this country in those days would feed anybody that come to their house.
There's a famous legend in the Southwest regarding buried treasure of the James boys somewhere in the Wichita Mountains.
Yes.
You ever hear of that?
Yes, several times. So 40 years ago, people come down here and went into the Wichita Mountains to see if they couldn't find it, but I don't think there's a thing in the world to it.
Well, is it true that Frank James lived for a time down there trying to find it himself?
No, I know he lived down here. He died down here.
Yeah, and whereabouts?
Well, it is south and west of here somewhere, but I can't tell you just where.
Probably near the Wichita someplace.
Back in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think then the treasure doesn't exist, perhaps, except in imagination?
No. In fact, I'd never thought of that and never come to my mind before that Frank did come down here and died down here, he and his wife. Of course, I don't know if his wife died here or not, but she was living when he died.
Was the...
I remember that well, and that I'd never thought of that in connection with the stuff that might have been buried down there, but I never did believe it.
Mm-hmm. You never went digging for it.
No, I never did that, no.
Which was the toughest gang? We use the word tough, meaning most desperate. The Doolins or the James boys?
Well, not the Doolins, the one ahead of them.
Jennings?
Four brothers that were all killed up
Dalton?
There.
Dalton?
You mean
Dalton? Dalton.
Dalton. He was a real aggressive and did more work during their time in life, but, you know, Coffeyville settled them. They stopped it, see. But, Lord, they robbed 3-4 banks a year. They were just on the go all the time and done a lot of killing.
Very
the
active.
Daltons did, yeah.
Well, did the Daltons get into Oklahoma very much?
Oh, they lived here. It was their home. Their father and mother lived out 9 miles northwest of Coffeyville where they robbed this bank. Emmett told me that he and Grant both tried their best to talk Bob out of robbing that bank there in Coffeyville.
That was the time when the three of them got shot, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, when
broke
they got
up the
killed.
Gang?
Yeah.
Wasn't there a... didn't they have a man that was supposed to be a pretty bad character named Red Buck? Or
yeah, sure, Red Buck.
Was,
I know him.
Was he really as
had
bad?
Red hair.
Was he really as bad as they picked him as a...
Why,
as a,
I think so. Of course, I don't know what's been said about him lately. I know Red Buck was supposed to be a killer. I remember that awful well.
Did you get down to the Texas very much, Major?
No, not in those early days.
Uh-huh.
Didn't I?
You ever heard of Sam Bass? Yes, then, did you?
I did. I remember well when they killed him down at Round Rock.
He was a historical
wasn't
character.
Wasn't it Round Rock? Where
yes. He was a historical character, of course.
Yeah, I stopped in I've seen my memory so bad. It's ever since I had that accident. I have trouble remembering
uh-huh.
stuff. But I stopped in a town down there in the Chickasaw Nation one time. And it wasn't a town, it was just a trading store. A fellow named Rucker run it. And passing from the trading store back to where I kept my horse in the stable, there was a lattice stable built up, built of lath and painted white. And there's a horse in there. And I went up and looked at him first time I passed there, and I thought he was a stallion. But still, one day when I was passing there, when the boys was around, I said, is this a stallion? And he says, no, sir. I says, what do you keep him up like this for? Well, he says, that's a horse that Sam Bass was killed off, and he says, killed off of, and he says, the old man is great friend of Bass's and liked him, and so he bought the horse and is going to take care of him as long as he lives.
To get back to the Boomers, we'll return to the Outlaws in a moment. Did you know Captain David Payne personally?
I knew him awful well, yes.
What type of man? How would you describe him?
A high-class gentleman. Meant all right. Here was where Captain Payne fell down. Captain Payne was just an ordinary-looking man. That is, you never take a second look at him. Nothing to attract him, and that is different from any other man. He's a man about 6 foot tall, big, fine-looking fella. But he just didn't know how to get into press. Now, the first day that I arrived in Wichita, Kansas, when I come out there, Marsh Murdoch, who was then the editor and owner of the Wichita Eagle, told me the following day, he said, Major, we got 52 telegrams after that 300-word message went out about you arriving and she was going to lead the Boomers into Oklahoma. Most of them, they all said they all read about Alex. They send us all the news you can get on Pawnee Bill and the opening of Oklahoma.
Go ahead, Major.
Well, Marsh Murdoch told me that. Now, up there in the Wichita building.
All right. We have 2 minutes on this side. You want to continue that?
Well, you mean the story?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was one of the reasons why Mr. Payne couldn't, all he had was himself personally. He didn't have the papers working with him. He would in any town that he was in. But what it needed to get the country open was the efforts of the whole country, for instance. Huh? Yes.
Press agent. Press agent.
Because people down in New Hampshire and Vermont, they didn't give a darn whether it ever opened or not. You see what I mean? But
weren't you folks afraid of the Army, the Boomers? Oh, no. Are they afraid of the Army?
They were down here, but they was across the line down here when I was organizing my Boomers when we had our big colony down there.
Well, if they knew the land couldn't be permanently held by them, what was the advantage?
Well, here was what happened. We created so much stir and dust that the President of the United States issued a proclamation opening at the settlement. Of course, we'd have been fired out just like Payne was if it hadn't been for
that. I see. Well, thank you, Major. We want to conclude now part one of this section of the WKY Historical Series with Major Gordon W. Lilly, Pawnee Bill. Part 2 of WKY's Historical Series with Major Gordon W. Lilly, known as Pawnee Bill. Well, Major, you were telling us very interesting things about the boomers there a moment ago. Do you want to add anything to that? Let me ask this question. What was the nature of the country? Was it plain like it is now? Were there many buffalo? What did it look like when you first came down?
Well, the first buffalo killing you can make was out about where Enid is now. That's where were the Indians, the Pawnees, from where I was located, used to go out there to get their buffalo meat. And that lasted for about 3 or 4 years after I came down here. Then the last of them that I ever heard of, was in the Wichita paper, said that there was about 30 or 40 of them down in the panhandle. And old Buffalo Jones, who lived at Garden City, Kansas, told me himself that when he heard that was all there was, he went down there and killed all of the grown ones and captured the calves. And I bought 3 of these calves, and that's what started my buffalo herd. I've got 50 now.
Well, we've heard remarkable stories about the number of buffalo. They say they were numbered in millions. Is that true?
Oh, there isn't any question about it. Just millions and millions of them.
Do you suppose that that was one contributing factor toward the country being a plain? In other words, did the buffalo trample down the trees and undergrowth?
No, I don't think that. The thing that held our country back here many years was the big prairie fire that went over it and burnt down the trees. That's one reason that our country, when it was opened up and when the white people came in here, had great trouble of making a living. There was nothing here at all, not even wood to burn, except along the seams.
How does the buffalo steak taste?
Well,
I can answer that for him.
Well, you come tell us then, will you?
Oh, he tastes wonderful.
It's wonderful.
He took lots of it because I have it up there anytime.
I got a roast to get ready for tomorrow.
He's your cook, too, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's charged my home.
All right. Well, now, we want to ask so many questions, we hardly know where to start. Let us say, for instance, who was the baddest bad man? We still want to get back to the outlaws. Who was the worst one?
The worst of them? Well, you know, the report went around just by word of mouth was that Jesse James was the killer of the James gang. And that Frank was a fellow that kind of held him down as much as he could. Now, I do know this, that when the Northfield Bank robbery took place in Northfield, Minnesota, that Jesse killed the president of the Northfield Bank when he sat in his chair at his desk and had both hands up. And he should not have killed him. He was censured awfully for it. And a man in Northfield who lived there and knew all about it, I asked him, I said, well, what the dickens did he do it for? Well, he said the report was that Jesse was darn drunk, that he staggered the day that they robbed that bank.
Well, who was the, perhaps the worst then, actually, the one that was most desperate?
Jesse always had that reputation.
Jesse had the reputation.
Now, I don't know anything of Frank. I never heard anything about Frank killing anybody. I know he's in all those robberies, you know, unless they did, but I don't know anything about it. There's no report on it. It came out.
Did you see very many actual gunfights?
Yes, and many of them around Caldwell.
Did you know Bat Masterson and Wyatt Arp?
Yes, he was a marshal there when I knew him.
That is, Arp was?
No, Arp wasn't. He was out west. He was out in New Mexico when I was in up around Caldwell.
What type of man was Wyatt?
Well, an awful fine man. You know, he was a clever, smart man.
Were they actually as quick on the draw as you hear sometimes?
Oh, yes, they was.
Did you ever see any great feats of marksmanship?
Well, I've seen them shooting at the marks, I mean, these men of those days who were killers, they didn't put in a lot of time practicing, so they could shoot.
They started when they were young.
But a man don't have to be very expert to shoot another one, because generally that's done in, pretty close together, close enough. For instance, a Colt six-shooter, if you're off 200-300 feet, it's mighty unreliable. That is, of course, you might hit them and you might not. That's the way I look at it.
Well, usually they'd get up close and then say...
Well, you take a Winchester rifle now, it's different. You can kill a man off 300-400 feet. It's as easy as you can if you're 3-4 feet, if you're a good shot with it.
They would have a sort of formality of gunfights, didn't they? In other words, they wouldn't draw unless the other one was ready or something like that.
Well, in these bank robberies and things of that kind, that didn't hold good. That would hold good generally, maybe, where a man was looking for another one.
Oh, I mean in personal feuds, such like.
Well, most of that stuff in those early days, for me to sit down here and tell you about these shootings, one thing or another went down here that looked like they happened every day, but they didn't. But the few people that lived here, would get the news from one or the other. You'd learn about those things going on.
Majority of the citizens then were peaceable and law-abiding.
All were.
What type of man was Masterson?
Very high-class man. Well, he worked on a New York paper the last years of his life. Was a sport editor.
He lived around Caldwell, Kansas, is that right?
No, he was at Dodge City.
At Dodge City.
I see him in that picture. I saw it advertised here today. That Masterson should have mentioned in that.
Well, how about Wild Bill, Mr. Hickok?
I know him. I saw Wild Bill. Cody always used to talk a lot to me. He knew him well.
I want to get to Mr. Cody in a minute. How about Calamity Jane?
I never saw her.
She was...
She lived up in the northwest, up around Deadwood. She's buried right alongside of Wild Bill's grave up there.
Well, that was not by Wild Bill's choice, was it?
Oh, no, he was dead then. It'd been that long. But here's what Cody said to me. I got a postcard from her once, wanting a job with the show. Well, I didn't know her. She didn't live anywhere around where I did. So I took the postcard in to Colonel. I says, Colonel, did you know Calamity Jane? He says, I'll say I did. And I says, here's a postcard from her. And I says, would she be any attraction to our show? He says, no, not a bit in the world. He says, he's ugly as a mud fence. That is exactly his words. And then he told me later on, we was talking about her one day, and he says, well, she was old Wild Bill's sweetheart for a long while. He says, she's buried right alongside of him up there now at Deadwood, I think, where he's buried.
When did you first meet Buffalo Bill, Major Levy?
1883.
What was your association through the years?
I took the Indians on there for him from the Pawnees tribe and was with him for 2 seasons. Then I left the Colonel, started my own show, and made money enough with it that I finally bought the Buffalo Bill show from James A. Bailey. That is Mrs. James A. Bailey. Bailey had just died. So I went up there and bought it. Well, they solicited me to buy it because they wanted to get rid of it, and they thought I'd be the only prospect they had, really, the man that understood running it.
Can you tell us a little of the personal recollections of Colonel Cody?
Oh, yes. He and I lived in a private car for 5 years one time. That'd be 7 months every year. Slept together either. We had and this was the cook on that car.
We might say we have the lady referred to sitting right here. What is your full name, please?
My name.
That's right.
Mrs.
Ruffner.
Ruffner. Ruffner.
R-U-F-F-N-E-R. Ruffner. All right. Now you tell us a little about Colonel Cody then, if you'd like to. You were the cook then. What did he like to eat?
Oh, he liked everything. Everything at all.
He liked everything, is that right?
Yeah, he liked everything.
Tell him a gravy story.
He liked his gravy, and he wants some oranges with cream on him, and after he had that, and he was deadly sick, and I had to get the doctor for him.
What about the gravy you referred to?
Oh,
he eat him on his hot cakes. He always wanted gravy on it.
He wants some hot cake and gravy, milk gravy on his cake.
Well, that's not a bad idea.
No, it's pretty good.
Thank you.
He said one morning, he said, Jimmy, if you don't know what to give me to eat, one morning give me eggs and bacon, and next morning give me bacon and eggs.
A variety. Well, that's interesting. Thank you so much, Mrs.
Buckner.
I'd like
to ask a question.
All right.
Of the major, did Colonel Cody ever refer to his much talked about duel with Yellow Hand?
No. The only thing I've ever heard him say about that duel, I don't like to say a thing that's against the public's belief in the Colonel, because he was an awful fine man, but I've heard him a number of times mention it in this way. He says the year that Yellow Hand was killed, or the year that Tall Bull was killed. You know, he had credit to kill them, both of them. But confidentially, I can't tell you that.
Well, that story never came from Colonel Cody. I think it came from his press agent, Nat.
Well, that's it, Nat Salisbury.
That's the fellow.
Yeah, I knew all those folks. I had to, because I'd done business with them.
Now then, to get back to the Boomers, will you see how many minutes we have left, please? To get back to the Boomers, what success did you have after you led them into this country in about 1879?
Why, wonderful, because I led them down here. However, my efforts in bringing them down didn't have a thing to do with it, because when the President of the United States issued a proclamation opening it for settlement on the 22nd day of April, 1889, well, I couldn't do anything for him any more than any other man could. I might hunt him up a good place or something, but I mean, as far as the thing was open then and free to everybody.
Done,
that's right. That was the end of it.
He got a big picture from himself
in the Jewish. Was you ever in the Historical Society out here?
No,
we've been out there, yes, sir.
Don't you remember that big picture's in there? They call it...
They haven't got his name.
They didn't even use my name on it. They called it... The Spirit of 89 or something like that.
I've seen that picture, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, I sat for that picture on a horse. Painter that painted it. He painted it up in my house.
Did you see the run, Major Lilly?
I was in it.
Yeah, the run of 89. Where did you run from?
We went in from Caldwell, Kansas. But we had to cross the Cherokee Strip before we got to the north line of old Oklahoma, which was 60 miles. We went down there. The soldiers allowed us to cross and go down there and get on the line down there, and that's where we went in, and that's near Buffalo Springs.
Did you settle on a bit of land for yourself?
No, I wasn't looking for land either. I wanted to be a showman, see, and I couldn't be bothered. That's right. Well, that taking them Boomers in is what made me. That is, there wouldn't have been much Pawnee Bill if it hadn't been for that. You know, those, I tell you, that Wichita Eagle sent out over 300 words by AP, and...
Go ahead.
And Marsh Murdoch, who was the editor then, told me that they got over 50 telegrams the next morning, send us all the news you can get on the opening of Oklahoma and Pawnee Bill's invasion from all over the United States. The big papers all over the United States.
Well, thank you so much, Major. I know our time is going very, very short.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do with this. My memory's so bad now since I had that accident that I can't remember dates at all.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would like to do would be to take more time sometime so I can look it up and figure out just...
We'd like to have you do that, Major.
So
this has merely been an informal discussion and chat with you this afternoon, because you happen to be down here from Pawnee, which is quite a drive, 100 miles away.
Yeah.
We're happy to have had you, and we hope it hasn't inconvenienced you a bit.
No, you're
looking fine today, and we certainly congratulate you.
Thank
you. Our time is just about up now, I believe. We want to say this has been one of WKY's historical series. The speaker has been Major Gordon W. Lilly, Pawnee Bill. It's recorded on April the 12th, 1939.
Pawneeville Ranch is owned and operated by the Oklahoma Historical Society. For more information, go to www.pawneevilleranch.com or find us on Facebook under Pawneeville Ranch and Museum.